This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Stay tuned, and we're going to talk about many things today. Lots of open questions, some rhetorical and some actual, for you to respond to.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Now, people who are used to listening to this show, Occupied Territory, which has been around for about a year and a half, are familiar with the fact that we've taken off the runway and soared into the air from just issues concerning the Occupy movement. But I don't want to anybody to ever think that we're abandoning that. The show was founded based on the principles of the Occupy movement, specifically income inequality, which if you examine what's going on in the world and, you know, recent history, past history, current events, you see that it's the root, at the root of almost everything else. It is truly the, what did Christ say? The love of money is the root of all evil. Well, the current version of that is the inequality of ownership and assets, and the inequality in income and money is the root of all current evil in this country and in the rest of the world, too. What's encouraging is, though, when you look at the news and you see what's coming out of different countries, not just this country, is clearly what's happening is income inequality is increasing everywhere. Now, why is that encouraging? Because sooner or later, it's either going to turn into a total world, and it looks this way. If you have a bleak point of view, it looks like a sort of a world corporate military government, one giant Skynet for the entire world, right? On the other hand, it could be that finally the original dreams of people like Marx or the original communists, and remarkable how it is when you say those words, there's some pejorative lingering in the air, right? I mean, if you live in America, especially, the very words, if you say Marxism or the works of Karl Marx, or you say communism, you can't get it out of your system, and you've been brainwashed so bad that there's something maybe a little bit crazy or dangerous or just plain sinful about it. Nevertheless, going back to the original hopes and wishes and propositions of Marx and Engels and of the idea of communism, which is not such a new idea. You can go back in history and see it. The ancient Christians practiced this. Cells. They even had something called cells. The idea of equality in its fullest, final sense, where that everybody on earth, nobody was better than anyone else and nobody had that much more than anyone else or any more than anyone else, so that we shared everything equally because finally it dawned on people. Will it ever? I don't know. Freud said it was a race between what he called Thanatos and Eros, a race between the human's seeming wish for suicide and death and the human desire to love and to be connected to other people. He said it was a race, and he didn't seem to be too happy about the outcome of the race, but that was him. He was a depressed old guy. Meanwhile, it looks as if when you look at the whole world, there are strikes in China, there are people who are organizing workers in Bangladesh. You see what, I mean, Europe we know about already. In South America, workers and environmentalists are actually, you know, serving on in cabinet posts. Sometimes they are actually changing the entire nature of governments down there. They're nationalizing governments and driving corporations nuts. What I'm saying is between this country, which lags behind in every aspect compared to most other countries, except for sheer dictatorships, like a place like Saudi Arabia or something, there is a sort of unity, a common understanding that we can't go on forever destroying the planet and starving people to death and treating people like slaves and murdering people, that it just can't go on forever this way. And even in what were formerly strict dictatorships, there is unrest. That's a polite word the papers use, unrest. So all of which is to say that when we talk about the Occupy movement, we're really talking about almost every issue that concerns all of us, and a lot of it has to do with income inequality, and it has to do with who we allow in our democracy, and we could, you have to say who we allow to the extent that we still control anything to do with our government. And I don't know how much that is anymore, but to the extent that that we control it in any way. Now, I don't mean the ideal. In other words, ideally, this is a representative democracy. Of course, it is far from that, and maybe further from that than it's ever been, possibly. It may actually be. Some of that has to do with the sheer size of the United States. There was a time about, for instance, this is how fast this country goes. In the 1940s, the population of the United States was one half of what it is now. So in approximately 70 years, roughly, the population of the United States doubled. And all over the world, the same thing is happening in most places. The population is going up and up and up. The larger the country is, of course, the more difficult it is to have your single voice or even your representational voice, if you have some sort of a union or a group of people or you vote in some block, the more difficult it is to be represented. So ironically speaking, the larger the place is, the easier it is for a small, vicious, willful group of usually very rich, very greedy, very power-hungry people, the easier it is for them to take control. Because everything is spread so thin. Democracy is spread so thin, you can see straight through it now. It's so fragile, you could stick your finger through it. And there isn't much that resembles a representative democracy here anymore. Basically, we have something closer to what we used to like an oligarchy or a kind of a monarchy where the president, the executive, has taken sort of sort of king-like powers, which is far from what the original design of the Constitution was supposed to be. Clearly, the president of the United States now has powers that are very much like a dictator or a king. And the people in his cabinet and the people who are behind him are sort of like the dukes and the earls, you know, the sir this and the sir that, the counts, the people who are the heads of corporations, the people, for instance, he just appointed to be Treasury Secretary, an even bigger corporate flack and hack and, prostitute for corporations than Geithner was. And that was hard. It's hard to do that, but he did. This guy named Jack Lew. So what we have is a kind of a monarchy in this country with a certain royalty underneath. That is to say, politicians who are subservient to corporations, corporate leaders, and the rich, who essentially own the government. And every couple of years, we, like good little sheep, we come out and we vote. And when that's when we are all going to sort of wake up, or I shouldn't say we, because the people who listen to this show, the people who listen to this show or who are aware of things like this have already awakened. They may be frustrated as to what to do about it, or they may know, as I feel like I'm increasingly coming to know and can't see any, because I can't see any other alternative, that the only way to change anything in this place anymore, since it's not really a democracy or even something resembling one, despite all the lip service, the only way to change anything is to go out in the streets, is massive civil disobedience. I don't know if that will ever happen. You see what happened to the Occupy movement, which is not dead and gone, but still underneath things now, sort of at a very low key, low level. And whether that will ever change, I don't know. It could be because there's a complex aggregation of cultural and economic determinants in this country. People are tired, they're passive, they're over-amused. The bread and circuses that the Romans used to distract the masses while they went around, with their imperial dictatorship, making people disappear, torturing people, crucifying people, invading other countries, using whatever wealth that the Romans had to further their own, their own ends. This kind of thing is not going to go away, and it's just getting worse all the time. So what happens is, more and more people are becoming aware of the fact that voting, especially voting through either of these two political parties, is a complete waste of time. It is not changing anything. I mean, really anything, for sure. Here and there, the issues become very clear. They become very marked. So like, for instance, in state governments, it's much more marked than in the federal government. So if you break it down locally, you have more control. It's that way with everything, right? On your block, in your community, in your city, you have somewhat more control over things than you do on a national level. On a national level, you have no control whatsoever. Lobbyists are in there everywhere all the time representing the rich. You don't have a chance. Your vote means nothing, except when it comes every 2 years or every 4 years when they need it. But on a state level, for instance, a lot of state governments have attacked women. Republicans, of course, have attacked women. You don't see that. So there's a difference between the Democrats and Republicans at a state or a local level. At a national level, the higher you get, the more prostituted the politicians of both parties have become at a national level to the interests of the rich. And so there's really no difference at all. The bottom line is that I think that people in this country have too much respect or passivity. They have too much respect for the law. Yeah, I'm saying it. People in this country have too much respect for the law. Now, if that respect may actually be fear. Like they do in religion, they say you're supposed to be in awe of God. You're supposed to fear God. I always was very interested in using in that terminology. You're supposed to fear God, but actually in this country, you're supposed to respect the president, and you're supposed to respect Congress, and you're supposed to respect the rule of law. In fact, I don't think anybody respects. Obviously, look at the polls. The ratings of favorability, whatever that means, the favorability rating of Congress is below that of roaches and the Communist Party. And I think there was something else. I think it was a disease called shingles. 9% of the people in the country said that they favored or had a favorable view of Congress. I don't know who those people were. I guess people who got contracts from Congress, the extended families of Congress. I don't know. But, people, they know it, but they don't want to know it. I mean, what are you going to do? You got these two political parties. They have managed to collude with each other to exclude all other possibilities from being on the ballot, from running, or from appearing in any kind of public debate. The Republicans and the Democrats long ago got together. It's like 10, 20 years already. Now, they've gotten together to exclude the possibility forever of any third-party candidate being up there during a presidential debate, a congressional debate, or a senatorial debate. Maybe at the state level, I don't know. It's possible, but probably not. They have locked it together. They have locked it together. So if you have two sides who theoretically are opposing each other, how easy is it? And, of course, it's occurred already for them to, behind the scenes, negotiate with each other to just carve everything up. Why fight with each other? It's like two mafia families who are warring and killing each other in some city somewhere. Once in a while, you know, the people with brains in these families get together and say, hey, you know, if we keep killing each other, the cops will be on our backs. The public will have a bad attitude and they'll start turning on us, and that could hurt us in some way. And also, you know, we'll run out of people. Everybody's getting killed. So tell you what we do, you know, let's get together over at Vinny's restaurant. What we're going to do. Am I using a stereotype? I guess. And we carved the place up. And this is, you remember from all these mafia books and mafia movies you've seen, get together and they carve up the territory. And they say, because once in a while somebody gets greedy and they want to take over the other territory, which is the essence of capitalism, right? But they carve it up. So, okay, so you have the north side, I have the south side. You sell your stuff on the west side, I peddle my stuff on the east side, and we don't have to go to war with each other, and we all get rich, right? So what the Democrats and the Republicans have done, and a lot of people identify themselves as Democrats or Republicans. You need to wake up from that too, in my opinion, right? I mean, that's also a delusion. What they've done is just carve up the territory like two mafia families. And they encourage the rest of us through their hired media and through their trained doggy media like MSNBC. MSNBC, I pick on them a lot, and I'm going to pick on them even more as time goes on because they're getting worse. The other day, MSNBC was on covering the inaugural. Did you watch any of the inaugural? Did you watch the president's bullshit speech? Did you watch him dancing with Michelle? My favorite part was, I could say that I'm watching this for homework. I watched about 10% of what went on. The first time around in 2008, like a lot of other people, maybe from my generation, or like a lot of other people entirely, I was fascinated and carried away by the idea of a black president and a black family living in the White House. Extraordinary, right? So everybody was celebrating this fact and all teary-eyed, but, you know, never did most of us think, although I'm sure some of you did, that this guy would turn out to be a company man of the worst sort, a military company man of the worst caliber, to use a certain word. So there I'm watching. My favorite part was where they go into, and you know, you could pick different channels to see the coverage of it, right? They had different commentators. I usually watch it through MSNBC, as much as I continue to stomach MSNBC, which is less and less all the time. I think probably I will, it's doubtful I'll ever look at MSNBC again until another election comes up, and then only for a couple of weeks before the actual election, midterms or the presidential election, because I can't stand them anymore. They're such bootlickers and ass kissers of the Democratic Party and the president. So I'm watching MSNBC, but one reason I watch them is they are smarter and funnier. They have a certain sense of wit and irony, and they're clearly smarter than the people on the other stations. And they once in a while will actually bring up something real or viable, depending on who, on what day it is. Somebody, Chris Matthews is hopeless, but Rachel Maddow once in a while might bring something up, although she's a lot more timid than she used to be. That may have something to do with the fact she gets, I don't know, $5 million a year and wants to keep her job and she likes being famous. But once in a while, this guy, Ed Schultz, is an interesting character. Ed Schultz probably makes between his radio and his TV shows, probably makes, I don't know, $10 million a year. He has a private jet, I think, right? And yet this guy gets a look on his face once in a while like, I don't think this is right. He seems to have a certain significant amount of conscience or what's fair or what's equal left over. Now, he's far, very unequal. He is one of the 1% at the top, right? And yet Schultz is the one who will take his show on the road. If there is a revolt in Madison, you know, like when Scott Walker tried to take over the state and throw out all the public unions and everything else, which he sort of successfully succeeded in doing. When people revolted in Madison, when people turned out and occupied the Capitol, Schultz was there, did his radio show from there for several days. Sometimes when there's a demonstration or there's a in a factory somewhere, if they sit down and occupy a factory, Schultz will show up. So he's an interesting character. So I was watching him the other day, and they're all talking about, I mean, they completely lost it on a place like MSNBC, which is why something like PRN, with its various political shows, is very important. Because we become sort of like, in the Middle Ages, the monks in monasteries, you know, forget about the religious aspect of it all. But the world was such a savage, vicious, ignorant, depraved place that it was like something out of a horrible nightmare or a Grimm's fairy tale. Every part of the world was crazy. It was beset by the plague. People, there are no schools anywhere. People, warlords ruled everything. People were regularly executed, beheaded, tortured. Rape was everywhere. Starvation was massive, right? And what happened was these monks got together and under the aegis of the church, they established these walled fortresses, which became, you know, these huge monasteries, basically. And they gathered all the scrolls in the world and all the tablets and all the learning and these vast libraries. And they copied these books out. They illuminate, you know, these illuminated copies. The libraries in these monasteries, in these walled religious cities of monks, were dedicated to preserving learning and maybe even to advancing it, although they weren't too fond of it. The church was not interested in advancing learning, but they preserved it anyhow. They faithfully, even though they didn't understand it sometimes, copied out stuff that they had from the library in Alexandria, from things that happened 1,000 years before them, 1,500 years before. They had ancient tablets. They had scrolls that went all the way back to Egypt. These people preserved knowledge. So it was like looking at a very dark, dark, dark sky, and one or two little twinkling lights were these places that preserve learning. And radio stations like this station and the handful of other, and I'm not just, I don't mean liberal stations, but actually sort of really left-wing or radical stations, although labels are too reductive. Labels are reduce things to the point where they are absurd. But, for instance, I think of myself as somebody who's just trying to be fair, trying to spread common sense around wherever he can, and also is just a humanist. And I don't mean that in an abstract academic way. I mean it that I'm concerned about other human beings, and I believe people should be concerned about each other, right? I don't see myself as leftist or radical. However, it's convenient to use those terms. So the few places in the country where you get this kind of thing, and I don't mean MSNBC, and I don't mean NPR, and I don't mean places like NYC in New York or wherever your local NPR station is. A local NPR station is basically a corporate-funded vanilla pudding version of liberalism, which is embarrassing. It's so silly and cowardly and so kowtowing to corporations that you're never going to get any real information. But now, for instance, Al Jazeera is going to be turning up. Al Jazeera English is going to be turning up on TV stations in different parts of the country. Al Jazeera English is, available on the Internet. And, of course, that's the Internet is where you have to go to get some real information these days. But as far as radio stations and TV stations, there hardly is any TV at all. You had Current TV. Now they're turned into Al Jazeera English. And it's up to your local area to see whether they carry it or not. But a place like MSNBC, forget about it, right? But you get a place like PRN, like this radio station, PRN.FM, and check out our lineup of political programs. It is the kind I'm talking about, right? Radical, truly not being carried away by any kind of romanticism or propaganda or funded by large corporations. MSNBC, they're covering the inaugural the other day. And they're covering it, and it was basically ass-kissing time all over the place. It was, how lovely she looks. She's finally, the president's wife is finally, Michelle is somebody who finally is unashamed to bring fashion back into, what? and at one point, Rachel Maddow, right, who should really know better, she is completely detached from her original moorings as anything liberal or even left-wing. Completely. She's lost it entirely. She has drifted totally into the midstream, right? And she's just one of them now. Basically, it's Democratic Party television, MSNBC. At one point, she's talking about the president going to a military ball, right? A military ball. Apparently, the president has different inaugural balls. And they were commenting on the fact that this year there will be fewer inaugural balls than there were last time. That's great. I'm glad to hear it, because last time, in the midst of millions of people being thrown out of jobs, starving, suicidal, depressed, no place to live, not enough food to eat, the president had 9, I think it was, or was it 13 inaugural balls, and went to all of them. The amount of money spent was like $35 or $40 million. This time it was close to $50 million. I have no idea what they spent on. Beyonce? Beyonce gets $50 million from, what is it, Pepsi-Cola. So you can get all that. She can make sure that everybody who listens to her and looks at her goes out to buy Pepsi Cola and gets diabetes and heart attacks. Good for her. You know, this is the land of opportunity. That's what I say. So Beyonce is there. Other entertainers were there. Famous people. They get paid like $500,000. They didn't do it for free. Screw free. It's funny. America is supposed to be the land of the free. There's nothing free in America. Maybe there's nothing free anywhere, right? There's no free lunch. That's another existential. That's a separate existential philosophical discussion. It's true. There is nothing for free. If you want something, it means you have to give up something else. True. True fact. True fact of existence. However, in this country, free is a dirty word. When people sing about the home of the brave and the land of the free, it has nothing to do with America anymore. So this Beyonce's there, and whoever it is, Kelly somebody, and this and that, and inaugural balls and special luncheons. And at one point, Rachel Maddow says, and apparently, I don't know who it was, this whole idea of going to a military ball where every, members of the service are there, in their best uniforms and their dance, and the president honors them by going to a military ball. He honors these people, and I suppose he has to, he personally, because he sends them out to die, and he sends them out to kill people all over the world in large numbers, and he sends them out to invade sovereign countries and to blow people up, whether they're guilty or not guilty. Sometimes it doesn't make any difference to him. He's the one who sends them all out to risk their lives. Maybe he personally should go to a military ball, but I don't like it that the president of the United States is honoring our service people at a military ball. The last war this country had that could even be reasonably defined as a good war, if any war could ever be called good, obviously. But the last thing we had that even resembled a morally a morally decent, you know, morally explainable war was World War II, when we fought the Nazis, specifically the Nazis. With the Japanese, it was complicated. But so we fought the Nazis. Couldn't be worse people in the world than the Nazis, right? Although half the world thinks that we're the Nazis now. But there couldn't be worse people than the Nazis. Imagine. No, there couldn't be. There hardly ever were. Or hopefully maybe there never will be, although there are some people giving them a run for their money right now in the world. So we fought them, right? The president wants to honor the people who died or got wounded or lost part of their lives or came back brain-addled or scared to death or crazy or angry for the rest of their lives. He wants to honor these people who made such a sacrifice fighting these truly evil people over there in Europe. That sounds okay to me, but there has not been once. I was born in 1945. I was born during World War II. And since I was born, there has not been one clear, decent American war. There has not been one case that I could see where American soldiers were sent out of this country to another place, and probably that even includes Korea, which is complicated. Maybe some justification there. But there has not been one place where America has gone since I was born in 1945, in Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, Grenada, troops, of course, underneath the radar in Nicaragua, and, you know, 25 other places, overthrowing governments, assassinating democratic leaders who were elected in various countries, providing troops and equipment and money and training for some of the most vicious right-wing death squads in the world, in the Middle East, in South America, and Central America, trying to assassinate Castro, the Bay of Pigs, as I say, Vietnam being the worst, and then Iraq, which extraordinarily has gone down in American history as a war where brave men and women sacrificed themselves for the cause of freedom, which, of course, is a delusion. It's a paranoid, psychotic delusion, also aided and abetted by, you know, all this celebration of our men and women who are defending our freedoms. Our men and women in service now, let's get this straight, are not defending our freedoms. Is there anybody listening to me now who actually believes that our men and women in uniform in combat areas are defending our freedoms? Do you feel like your freedom is being protected by the fact that we have soldiers in Iraq, or we had soldiers, we still have some, and that we have soldiers in Afghanistan, and that we have missiles being launched off ships 1,000 miles away and blowing up people, that we have drones murdering people all over the place? Do you feel like this is really protecting your freedoms? If you do, I would love to know why you feel that. Or let's put it on a more practical basis. And this is an open question. Now, here's a real question. Obviously, before that was a rhetorical question. Do you feel like your safety is being preserved, or your safety is involved by the fact that we are using drone strikes increasingly all over the world to destroy people who we say are our sworn enemies? Although about one quarter to one fifth of the time, we blow up people who are non-combatants, even totally innocent civilians, in Yemen, in Somalia, probably in two or three other different countries, certainly in Pakistan, all over the place, which is why the entire country of Pakistan hates our guts now. I mean, you know, they were never too crazy about us to begin with, but now they really hate us. And even people who aren't, you know, like Islamist fringists or people who are, you know, sworn enemies of ours in some other way, from some other era or for some other movement. I mean, people in Pakistan really hate the United States of America. I mean, we routinely violate their sovereignty. I mean, we treat them with utter contempt. Their sovereignty or their safety is meaningless to us. We blow people up every single day over there, you know, with missile strikes or mortar strikes or fighter bomber strikes, you know, bombing raids, and certainly with drone attacks. And then in Afghanistan, do you feel actually safer because we're doing that? Now, this is an open question, and I bring this up because there is a parallel show to this show, and it's called Occupied Territory, but it occurs on Facebook. So whatever I say here, and issues that I bring up here, and issues that have to do with the fact that we don't have a representative government, that the government is not prosecuting the people who are the real criminals in society, but going after people like us who are protesting or righteously pointing out where they are, where our government is in league with corporations and ruining our country and ruining our culture and ruining our government. when we point this out, we're the criminals now, right? But they won't arrest the real criminals. They won't cut the budget of the people who are murdering people all over the world in our name, your name, my name, using our tax money. Now, if you want to get involved in this discussion, and I'm going to continue it in a little bit here, this military stuff, then go to the Facebook page, Occupied Territory. So just Google Occupied Territory and Facebook, and you will see a running conversation on all these different issues that I bring up here. And maybe every day or every other day, I will post some new report that has come out about how the government allowed the gangster bankers to get away with ruining the society that we live in, ruining our country, even ruining our personal lives, and the driving the cost of food up and everything else, and never being once even threatened with the idea of jail, let alone that, getting rich in the process, getting our tax money, giving themselves bonuses, making tremendous profits, living off the misery and the death and the suffering of other people in our country here, which is supposed to be our democracy, right? The government, it's like a marshal in an out-of-control Western town out in some vicious territory where there are drunks, everybody, lunatics, bands of marauding gangsters everywhere. And the marshal spends their whole time actually just handing out guns and ammunition to these people and letting them do whatever they want. Shoot up the town. Don't check your guns. Don't put anybody in jail. Just lay in your cot and snooze. This is what's going on in our government. Now, if you want to get involved in this, go to Occupied Territory on the Facebook page there and get involved. I took a post that I put up the other day that had to do with the president's inauguration and his new 4 years of whatever he claims he's going to be doing. And I put up the whole idea of drone attacks. And there's a lot of disagreement from people about that. There's a lot of people who identify themselves as liberals or as Democrats or whatever, and who still feel like it makes any sense or any difference whatsoever to participate in a Democratic Party, who object to my point of view about I call the president a murderer in print on the Occupied Territory page. And I've said that here, and I'll say it again. I think that the president of the United States is a murderer. What does that mean? I worked for a long time in the probation department, and I know a little bit about the law. And a murderer, and this is just in general usage, linguistic understanding, a murderer is somebody who you immediately think when you hear the word murderer, you know, like, for instance, if there's a robbery and somebody gets killed, you think, oh, well, somebody got killed during the course of a robbery. Or if a gun goes off accidentally and somebody dies, or if somebody gets hit by a car because somebody was drunk, that's one thing. But a murderer, if you use that word, it means that somebody has knowledge beforehand, who plans something and knows, for instance, after the fact that they actually killed somebody and, let's say, does it again, knowing that what they're doing is killing people. Based on all that, the president, who just got inaugurated and everybody was swooning over them. Well, I should remember these. I keep bringing things up and I let them go. Rachel Maddow, before I go on with this, Rachel Maddow the other day said that the president is going to a military ball to honor our service people. And apparently the president, that is to say Obama, recreated these military balls. Before that, they hadn't been allowed to languish, even with this asshole Bush, right? I mean, who is good for killing, who loves sending the military over to kill everybody, but couldn't care less about veterans or actual service people. But Obama, you know, at least maybe having some sense of conscience, perhaps, I don't know, decided to honor them because he's sending people off to kill people all over the place, and people are getting killed in the American service, branches. He recreated the idea, or he reemphasized the idea of a military ball. And Rachel Maddow says, isn't that nice? Isn't that nice? Listen, forget about it. MSNBC, isn't that nice? And at that point, Ed Schultz gets a look on his face like, Jesus, one of us here, one of us multimillionaires who have been kissing the ass of the president and the Democratic Party all day should say something real, you know, to balance this out. So he gets this sort of somewhat pain-stricken, maybe a little bit sort of timid look on his face because he's surrounded by all these ass-kissers. And he says, but there is some concern about the president's – he says this almost like totally out of the blue. There's some concern about the president's drone policies and drone strikes. The CIA, which conducts most of these strikes and, kills all our alleged enemies overseas, to no avail, by the way. all of these drone strikes. Rachel Maddow says, it's so nice that the president has recreated the idea of a military ball. No, it's not nice, Rachel. It's not nice at all. The military serves because we need them to serve. If they do something that we should be proud of, we should honor them. But to elevate them, as this president does, above everybody, to surround himself at speeches, at state, he's going to make a State of the Union speech. You watch the next State of the Union speech. There will be all these guys who have been in men and women who have been in Afghanistan, who have been wounded or had chests full of medals. They'll be sitting up there with the First Lady. They'll be all over the place. Generals, admirals, grand poobahs of the drone, the heads. There'll be so much metal hanging from people that they're going to be weighed down if they don't get held up. He loves generals. He loves the army. He loves to have all these people around him. I think it makes him feel like a real man. Just wandering slightly into psychological motivations. I think Obama doesn't really feel like a real man. So one way you could do it if you're president is blowing people up all over the place, killing Osama bin Laden, and bragging about it, and surrounding yourself with tough guy generals, all named General McRipper, the head of Special Ops. Special Ops, Medal of Honor. To me, the military is a necessary evil. I am not proud of our men and women in the service. I don't thank them for their service overseas. There's nothing to thank them for. I think it's a thankless thing. I feel sorry for them. I feel sorry that they had no other way to find a job or get an education but to join the military. I mean, the economy is so screwed up and there's planned unemployment, a certain acceptable level, quote unquote, of unemployment. So many people are out of jobs, and it's almost planned this way sometimes to keep people hungry and starving so that they don't form unions or expect better from their employers. So where's there left to go? There's nothing to do at all. No way to earn a living, no way to learn anything past high school except joining the service. So people do that. A lot of black people do it. A lot of poor whites do it, right? They join the service because there's nothing left for them to do. There's no place else for them to go because the society is basically a kind of a meaningless place where jobs are routinely shipped overseas by the heads of corporations and by large corporations to use slave labor in other countries. So join the service, right? Used to say, when I was a kid, they used to say, join the Navy and see the world. At least you got a free trip. Want to go see the Philippines? You want to see girls in hula costumes? Join the Navy, pal. Join the Navy and see the world. But now we celebrate these people all over the place. So I feel sorry for these people. If you're in the National Guard and you've been serving 2, 3, 4 tours in a row, whether you like it or not, through some blip or something in the law that allows the president to command your services from the National State Militia, from the National Guard, he takes you out of the Illinois National Guard, throws you into combat in Iraq or Afghanistan, and keeps you there. Puts you in for another tour and another tour till everybody's got PTSD. They're shooting women and children over there. They're urinating on people. They're going out of their minds. And they come back here. They're shooting their own families and they're killing themselves. The rate of suicide in the military is higher now than it has been at any time in American history, relative to the number of troops. And especially if you look at the time of combat. In World War II, when you had a larger portion of the population. In World War II, there was a larger portion of the population involved in fighting and involved in the service than anything compared to how it is now, right? There were far, far, far fewer. You can't even make a comparison of what they call cases of combat fatigue. People were in for the duration then, too. When you were drafted in World War II, or if you joined in 1941 or 42 or 43, you were in for however long it took. And there were people in there for years, 3 years, 4 years even, in the Navy, in the Army, right, in the Marines. Long, long time. And the only way you got out of that mess, got off sleeping off the ground or in a jungle someplace or getting blown up or getting, thrown into some massive attack somewhere where your chances were slim. The only way you got out of that life, which was hardly living at all, was to get wounded seriously enough so you had to come back home. So you lose a foot, you get shot through a lung, or you get wounded a couple of times, and they send you home. That's the only way you got out of it. And yet, with all of that, with all and the amenities, were nothing compared to what they have now in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm not saying they have it easy, even compared to Vietnam. In World War II, you got nothing, right? And if you got anything, you were lucky. They sent soldiers, they sent tens of thousands of soldiers to fight the Battle of the Bulge in the coldest winter in Europe in 100 years. And they didn't even give them winter coats. They didn't even have them, get it together to give them winter coats. These people went through things that people in Vietnam, and particularly in Afghanistan and Iraq, never went through. And yet, why is it that more of soldiers are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan with PTSD and brain injuries and mental illnesses, are committing suicide in record numbers, and are murdering their own families and other people randomly on military bases and other places? Why is that, do you think? I'll tell you why it is. Because there is no morality to what we're doing. People at bottom, most human beings, unless they're completely deranged or born in some strange way, and this is a very, very small minority of people, people are essentially decent. That's my belief. People have a sense of what's right and wrong. And everybody, except for a few people who like to kill people, there's always people in the Army and the Marines who love killing people. So the Army and the Marines is a good place for them. You just have to keep them on a leash, maybe throw them in a cage so they don't kill, you know, random people. And set them out and point them in the right direction when we really need them, right? So there's people who like to kill people. Well, there's always some people like that. Then there's people who are professional soldiers and professional Marines and professional sailors and professional, you know, drone killers. These people want to rise up in the ranks, like anybody who's in a corporation or in an office somewhere. You want to get promoted and promoted and promoted, right? Maybe you're in the U.S. Parks Department and you want to make it to supervisor or regional supervisor, or you're an insurance company or whatever. You want to get promoted. This is what America, right? You work your way up. But in the Army, the only real good way to work your way up is if there's fighting going on. Why do you think the military loves these wars, the profession of military? They love them because it's a great way to speed up through the ranks. Instead of languishing for years as a captain until you're in your 40s, all of a sudden you're a major, and then you're a colonel. Zip, 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 you go straight up. You have combat experience. There's a war going on. There's turnover. You go right up to Latin. Now, aside from the professional soldiers and the lunatics who like actually killing people wherever they can get a chance, who are in uniform, the vast majority of the men and women in the armed services are in there because they couldn't find a job, or because they are in some temporary delusional state where they think it was their patriotic duty. They soon find out that, of course, that it's not. So the reason that there are so many cases of PTSD and mental illness and depression and suicide coming back from these places where there isn't, relatively speaking, that much war going on compared to Vietnam or World War II, reason for that is because we're in the wrong place. And this happened in Vietnam, too. In Vietnam, we had a gigantic jump in the number of PTSD cases and of suicides, depressions, and lives ruined. I knew a guy in Park Slope in Brooklyn, like 20, 30 years ago. This guy was a very smart guy. He was a guy I knew. He did sort of handiwork, and he used to fix things around in people's houses and stuff like that. But he couldn't speak to anybody across a dinner table. He couldn't be with anybody. He used to spend time up in his, he was in the 101st Airborne and seen lots of nasty stuff, right, in Vietnam. He spent a lot of time in his apartment cleaning his rifle, which he managed to smuggle home from Vietnam. And he cleaned it and cleaned it and cleaned it, made sure it was there. If he heard a noise, he would grab it. He kept it at his bedside and he'd grab it. You couldn't really speak to him. He was completely out of his mind, right? And originally a very decent guy, good-hearted guy. But after that war, and a lot of people in my generation, I'm in my 60s, know people like that in their own families and other people. Those two wars, that war, Vietnam, and then Iraq, and then Afghanistan, have driven people crazy because people essentially are decent and they're human. And they know they're over there for the wrong reasons, that they're killing people and they're being killed for no good reason. There is no moral cause for them to be over there. It's not a question of right and wrong. They don't belong over there, no more than we belong to Vietnam. Vietnam was even worse in some ways. But we have no business being over in these places. And they know that the President of the United States has, even if they're not that educated, they know that the President of the United States has taken complete control of the military to the point where he doesn't ask Congress. We used to live in a country, listen to this, boys and girls, once upon a time, we lived in a country where you had to go and ask the representatives of the people of the United States. They were called congressmen and senators. You had to ask them if you wanted to murder people overseas or go to war, using all of our tax money, putting us in tremendous debt, and risking the lives of our fathers, brothers, sons, and now, of course, if you look at the paper today, of our mothers and daughters and sisters. If you want to risk these people's lives, you want to spend all that money, you had to go to the people of the United States in the form of Congress and say, I want to do this. You don't have to do that anymore. Because of this bullshit Patriot Act, which people in Congress are too scared because they want to preserve their own careers and their own, you know, revolving doors into corporations, they're too scared to do anything about. The Patriot Act, which is renewed, you know, once in a while, and other acts that the president signs and that Congress passes to give him more and more power in the executive, takes away their ability to decide whether or not the president is allowed to invade other countries, to kill people, and to use drone strikes. All of which is to say that if you wanted to, I went off on another tangent here. When you want to comment on this, I was saying that the president is a murderer, that he has no right to be conducting these drone strikes all over the place when he routinely is informed for years now that he is killing innocent people in the course of these drone strikes. When he is making these incursions in other countries, he shouldn't be allowed to do it. There should be much more oversight and review. And he is ignored. The CIA has just come up with some new rules. They call it a playbook because everything's a football game to these jock morons in Washington. To them, it's just another football game. What difference does it make to them? If you're sitting at a screen, a console in Nevada or upstate New York on an Air Force base, and you get some military intelligence, and you press a button, and a drone, a predator drone, blows up a bunch of people in a village, maybe some of them were evil and guilty of what, you know, we can only guess. Sometimes I suppose they are bad people, and certainly the Taliban are not people that you want anything to do with. In fact, the Taliban should probably, if we could clearly identify who the worst of them are, probably you can't reason with them, and they're dangerous. They're like, you know, rabid dogs. Maybe they should be shot down where they stand, but not in the middle of a village or on a roadside where there's children, you know, collecting firewood or something, which we routinely do. So the president murders people with these drones. And the CIA, the Congress, the Senate, actually the Senate Intelligence Committee, just sent a memo to the White House. And they routinely have been asking for years. The Senate Intelligence Committee wants the White House to send them the legal justification, the legal memoranda prepared by the Justice Department and the President's counsel to justify why it is he can go all over the world and murder people at any whim that he feels like on any intelligence without ever informing Congress. Not only does he not ask them in advance anymore if he wants to kill people, which he does routinely, he doesn't even have to tell them afterwards that he did it. He doesn't even have to tell them why he did it. It's totally out of control. We have a king. We didn't have an inaugural the other day. We had a coronation. Am I the only one who feels this way? That's why this show is here, I think, right? So they ask for these. So the CIA has come up with something new. They call it a playbook because they're supposedly responding to complaints and doubts on the part of an increasing number of people about these drone strikes, which, by the way, have no effect whatsoever except to make more people hate the United States. Any study, I could find you 50 studies by nonpartisan or international groups like the UN or whatever, and I don't mean, you know, like left-wing groups, studies by universities, studies by whoever, right, Amnesty International, places will show you that our drone strikes overseas, no matter how many Taliban commanders or commanders of al-Qaeda in Yemen or al-Qaeda in Mali or whatever it is, no matter how many of these people we kill, it has not made one bit of difference in their organizing ability and their ability to attack. They have killed, by their own, you know, estimate, something like 2,000 Taliban commanders and 2,000 Taliban fighters in Pakistan and in Afghanistan over the last several years. Now, every week, there's an attack in the middle of Kabul against the police barracks, against the National Intelligence building, against, you know, right in the middle of this capital city. The people, the Taliban, is more powerful, more dangerous, and more pervasive in Afghanistan and Pakistan than it ever was before. And they have more recruits there and all over the rest of the world because of the way we're acting. Now, Balanced on the other side, because I want to try to be fair here. So we have our king who likes to murder people who got crowned the other day, or recrowned. Now, this is an article today in the New York Times. It's called The Taliban of Timbuktu. So I said there'll be an open question here, and you can go to Occupied Territory on Facebook, and you'll see somebody down here at the station moved, this was a post from a couple of days ago, moved it up to the top about the inaugural and the president using drone strikes to murder people. And this is from an op-ed piece today. Before the recent French intervention in Mali began, by the way, in Mali, the French, recently just sent soldiers, and they're sending more soldiers all the time, and they're using their air force to bomb, Islamist jihadist soldiers, if you can call them that, in Mali, right? Because they're about to take over the entire country. This is a big country we're talking about, Mali. Take a look on the map. But Americans, by the way, if you look between the lines, what happened was there was a huge battle, a couple of huge battles. That was 6 months or a year ago, where the Americans, American had trained for the last several years. America, without you knowing about it or anybody knowing about it, and probably Congress either, America has been training and supplying the Malian army to fight these Islamist, insurgents, whatever word you want to use. And they're all zealots. They're all lunatics, of course, religious zealots. And actually, you know what? They're not really religious zealots. The ones, maybe some of them are, in Mali or in some Middle Eastern countries, or maybe the Taliban. There's a lot of religious zealots. They're crazy. But it's not just that. They're really basically just pirates. They're thieves, they're murderers, and they're rapists. And they use God as an excuse. But a lot of them are, religiously out of their minds. Here's the op-ed piece. Before the recent French intervention in Mali, the United States trained all these people and gave a tremendous amount of our tax money, weapons, to the Malian government and to the Malian army. In the first big battle with the Islamists, almost the entire Malian army that we had equipped and all the weapons we gave them, these guys deserted, went over to the other side, and now that's why they have so many weapons on the other side. They took our money, our weapons, and our training that we gave them, and just flipped it right over to the other side. So much for our intervention. And the drone strikes don't work. They don't preserve your freedoms. They don't protect your freedoms. They stir up people all over the place who aren't even political in the first place. What do you think? You're in a village somewhere. You send your kids out to get firewood. Four of them, they all get blown to pieces so bad you can't even identify them. Bloody skulls and limbs and fingers all over the place. And then somebody comes along and says, what do you think of the Americans? You say, where do I go to kill them? These drone strikes do not make anything safer for us over here, and they certainly aren't making the troops safer over there. And not only that, they have recruited hundreds of thousands of people to join up and kill us. All right, so this article here. Before the recent French intervention in Mali began, 412,000 people had already left their homes in the country's north, fleeing torture, summary executions, recruitment of child soldiers, and sexual violence against women at the hands of fundamentalist militants. Late last year in Algeria and southern Mali, I interviewed dozens of Malians from the north, including many who had recently fled. Their testimonies confirm the horrors that radical Islamists, self-proclaimed warriors of God, have inflicted on their communities. The fundamentalists ban music in the country, which has one of the richest musical traditions in the world. Last July, they stoned an unmarried couple for adultery. The woman, a mother of two, had been buried up to her waist in a hole before a group of men pelted her to death with rocks. In October, the Islamist occupiers had begun compiling lists of unmarried mothers. These people are crazy. They're rabid dogs, and they're trying to take over countries all over the place. Is it our job? And here's a legitimate question. I said I'd get to it around leading up to it in the last minutes here. Is it our job? Is it the job of the United States of America, our tax money, our military, our soldiers, to patrol the whole world? The world is full of rabid, mad dog killers who hate the United States and are taking over vast territories all over the rest of the world. And they are really not to be reasoned with. They have to be killed to be stopped. But are we the ones to do it? Do you want our soldiers to do it? Maybe you do. Maybe we should just come out and have a national vote on this, like a poll. Should we be the sheriffs, the marshals of the whole world? I really don't know the answer. Do you want to let these people run all over the world like crazy rats eating everybody? I don't know. I don't know the answer to this. That's why I asked the question. But I don't like it that the President of the United States ignores our elected representatives, murders whoever he wants, and then tells them to go screw themselves when they ask for his justification. I don't like it. And as far as his coronation Monday, good luck to all of us. He said everything everybody wanted to hear. The New York Times was ecstatic. They had orgasms over there. President states progressive agenda. Really? Let's see what the man actually does. He's in the palm and the hand and the pocket of the bankers. Let's not be too surprised if he doesn't do one damn thing.